I'm Tracy Sable. Tonight on EWTN News Nightly, peace on the horizon. Israel works on details to finalize a ceasefire. We have team coverage. The road ahead. A look at the latest on the California wildfires and plans to rebuild the ravaged area. A sign of great hope. Cuba announces the release of several hundred prisoners. Why it's giving credit to the Vatican. Plus, if you rebuild it, they will come. A major milestone for Notre Dame Cathedral in the weeks since it reopened. These stories and more tonight.
From EWTN, the Global Catholic Network, this is EWTN News Nightly.
Thank you for being with us on the feast of Pope St. Marcellus. Our top story tonight, uncertainty overshadows the Israel-Hamas ceasefire deal that was just announced yesterday. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu now says that a last-minute crisis with Hamas is holding up approval of the deal by the Israeli cabinet, which was expected to vote on it. Meanwhile, Israeli airstrikes reportedly killed at least 72 people in the war-ravaged territory. We have comprehensive team coverage. Capitol Hill correspondent Eric Rosales brings us reaction from U.S. lawmakers in just a moment. But we first begin with White House correspondent Owen Jensen. Owen.
Tracy, speaking from the U.S. State Department today, President Joe Biden's top diplomat, Antony Blinken, who now just has a few days left in his role, made clear where the U.S. stands on the now shaky deal between Israel and Hamas. And Blinken also got heckled.
In Gaza City, war wounded arrive at a hospital after a deadly Israeli bombardment. As for the ceasefire to stop the fighting and free hostages, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's office accusing Hamas of reneging on parts of the agreement. In Washington, at his final briefing before reporters, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken laying out what's at stake.
We've worked to broker a deal that would bring hostages home, that would stop the fighting, that would surge humanitarian aid to people who so desperately need it, that would create the space to conclude a permanent ceasefire. We now have that, and we expect implementation of the agreement to begin on Sunday.
Blinken also faced interruptions. Diplomatic security physically removed one person who shouted, "Why aren't you in The Hague?" A reference to the world's top war crimes court.
Please, sir, respect the process. Thank you.
Oh, respect the process. Respect the process. Well, everybody from Amnesty International. From Amnesty International to the ICJ saying that Israel's doing genocide and extermination, and you're telling me to respect the process. Criminal! Why aren't you in The Hague? Why aren't you in The Hague? Why aren't you in The Hague?
President Joe Biden says the ceasefire deal follows the elements he laid out in May.
Yesterday I announced, the proud announcement of the ceasefire, the hostage deal between Israel and Hamas. The road to that deal was not easy.
Soon after the conflict started, Biden sent U.S. troops into the area to prevent the war from spreading and defend against rocket attacks. Today, he spoke at the Defense Department's Commander-in-Chief farewell ceremony.
It's taken 8 months, a nonstop, relentless effort of my administration to get it done. But because of you, all of you standing behind me, because of you, because of so many diplomats and defense professionals, we kept the pressure on Hamas, and we got it done.
Secretary Antony Blinken traveled 12 times to the Middle East to try to halt the fighting. His boss, President Joe Biden, and President-elect Donald Trump have both claimed credit for the ceasefire deal that went into effect yesterday, that was agreed to yesterday, I should say, supposed to take effect this coming Sunday. But we'll have to wait and see if that really does happen at the White House. Owen Jensen, EWTN News Nightly.
All right, thank you, Owen. And for more, let's bring in Michael Singh with the Washington Institute. Michael, good to be with you today. Israel has delayed the vote on the ceasefire deal until Friday. Talk to us about the possible reasons for this holdup.
Well, the reasons that Prime Minister Netanyahu gave for the holdup are, you know, he's accused Hamas of reneging on some of the details of the deal about exactly which Palestinian prisoners would be released under the ceasefire agreement. I think most observers, though, look at this and they view it as sort of Israel's internal politics working itself out, because there are two parties in Prime Minister Netanyahu's coalition, both sort of hard right parties, which have threatened to leave his coalition over this deal. And if they were to both leave, he would lose his majority in government and would be significantly politically weakened. And so I think what we're seeing is sort of some maneuvering within the Israeli government to try to shore up the coalition, provide reassurances so that Netanyahu doesn't lose his coalition.
Yeah, Secretary of State Antony Blinken is still certain, though, that this agreement will go into effect as planned on Sunday. How confident are you, Michael, that the deal will stick and it won't be violated like back in November of 2023?
Well, I think the deal will stick. It does seem as though what we're hearing from all the parties is, yes, barring these kind of last-minute disagreements over details, which I think will be worked out, this agreement is going to go into effect. And I think for Prime Minister Netanyahu, this is essentially a deliverable for the incoming president, for Donald Trump. And to back away at this stage would start him off with President Trump in a very difficult footing. I think we can be sure, however, that the deal will be violated. You know, this is a deal which really sort of only entails details about one phase, a first phase lasting, you know, just 50 or 60 days, perhaps. And it's really unlikely that this is going to bring a permanent end or a lasting end to what is a very difficult situation in Gaza.
Yeah, difficult indeed. As mentioned, both the Biden and Trump administration worked on this deal. If the first phase of this doesn't go into effect, how do you think President like Trump will respond?
Well, you know, I think that probably the first phase will go into effect, and President Trump has already sort of taken some credit for that. Obviously, he issued some threats, some sort of really tough language, which he believed was important in getting the deal done. And he may well be right about that. But we've also heard from some of his nominees, like Secretary of Defense nominee Pete Hegseth, that the administration was prepared to provide Israel with what it needed to destroy Hamas, as they said. And so I think that the sort of stance that he's trying to take is he's trying to be a peacemaker, saying, I brought this deal to fruition, but ultimately to also show that he has Israel's back, and if it falls apart, to provide them with what they need to essentially go after Hamas.
Yeah, before I let you go, I want to touch on Iran. You know, many world leaders are praising this deal and optimistic about potential peace in the region, but Iran's supreme leader is calling this deal a victory for Palestine and a defeat from Israel. Michael, help us unpack that and your thoughts on that.
Well, it's not surprising that Iran's supreme leader would claim victory here. But I think if you look at the events of the past, you know, year and a half, 2 years, it really is a defeat for Iran. You know, they perhaps had more success than they had hoped on October 7th in terms of the number of Israelis that they were able to kill, the penetration of Israel they were able to achieve. That was engineered, I think, by Iran. Along with some of Iran's other proxies, including Hamas, obviously. But since then, you know, Hezbollah in Lebanon, another Iranian proxy, has been decimated. The Assad regime, a key Iranian partner, has fallen in Syria. And Iran itself has been hit a couple of times quite severely now by Israel. And so Iran is looking probably more weak and more exposed than it has at any point since its 1979 revolution. And frankly, Iran could be next on the target list for President Trump and for Prime Minister Netanyahu.
Oh, Michael, we're going to leave it right there. Thank you so much for weighing in and for your insights. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Well, here in the U.S., lawmakers are speaking out about the breakdown in the tentative deal. Capitol Hill correspondent Eric Rosales continues our team coverage and joins us now with the latest. Eric.
Good evening, Tracy. Yes, lawmakers I talked with had a range of feelings. Many are happy that a deal may be close to being finalized, but frustrated with the new rounds of delays. That's holding up the release of some of the hostages, including several Americans. Republicans were quick to point out that Hamas wouldn't even have come to the table if it were not for President-elect Donald Trump.
Remember, Trump is the one who greenlighted the death of Soleimani, a horrible Iranian terrorist. And when President Trump said there's all hell to pay if these hostages aren't released, Hamas takes them seriously, as they should.
Because of Donald Trump, you're going to actually see some movement on this, and I think we're going to get the hostages freed. We're going to get it done. Bibi's going to get it done. With Donald Trump as the leader of the world, it's going to get done.
The biggest thing that I can tell the American people is peace through strength has always been a message with this incoming administration, and you're seeing that play out on the international stage, so we're happy about it.
The release of the hostages held for more than 15 months remains top of mind.
I'm very concerned. You know, we absolutely need these hostages for a ceasefire deal, ASAP, and I think we're all praying for that.
But Congressman Tim Burchett tells me he's not even confident the hostages are alive.
Honestly, don't believe that many of them are alive. They have a bad habit of killing the people early, burying them out in the desert somewhere, and then making the family suffer for years, thinking that their loved ones are still alive.
Some lawmakers are not surprised Hamas, a terrorist organization, is changing the terms.
Even in this hostage prisoner exchange, that does not mean that Gaza is going to end up being some safe haven of terrorism. That doesn't mean that those who are actually terrorists aren't going to continue to be pursued by the IDF, Israel, and others.
Democrats say the Biden administration and Israel have reason to worry about the delay.
The Israelis know they're making a deal with the devil in Hamas. And so I'm sure there's all sorts of concern that Hamas is trying to add new prisoners that aren't agreed to at the last moment, or whether Hamas is going to live up to their end of the deal.
Bottom line, U.S. lawmakers hope something can be worked out and bring the hostages home, something that family members of those captured have been praying for since October 7th, 2023. I also want to let you know about something else. More than 60 Democrats voted for Congresswoman Nancy Mace's bill today. The Republican-led legislation makes sexual and domestic violence deportable offenses for illegal migrants. The bill now moves over to the Senate for a vote. And Tracy, this bill, along with the Laken Riley Act, could be some of the first pieces of legislation signed by President-elect Donald Trump.
Thank you so much for that, Eric. Ad staying on Capitol Hill now. Florida's governor names the replacement for Marco Rubio's Senate seat. Ron DeSantis says that Republican Ashley Mooney, currently the state attorney general, was picked because of her proven track record.
This is a once in a decade, maybe even once in a generation opportunity in this current Congress is ultimately going to determine whether we do usher in that revival of the American experiment, or is it just going to be status quo, passing the buck, and nothing ever changes?
Mooney has been Florida's top law enforcement officer since 2018. She has fought for many pro-life issues and supported the governor in the fight against so-called gender-affirming care for minors. She is taking the seat of Marco Rubio, the president-elect's nominee for Secretary of State. Also, Senate confirmation hearings for President-elect Donald Trump's cabinet continue today. Lawmakers heard from Doug Burgum for Interior Secretary, Scott Turner for Housing Secretary, Lee Zeldin for Environmental Protection Agency Administrator, and Scott Bessent for Treasury Secretary.
President Trump's energy dominance vision will end those wars abroad, will make life more affordable for every family in America by driving down inflation. And President Trump will achieve those goals while championing clean air, clean water, and protecting our beautiful lands.
Because of climate change, and I think that he's concerned about the economic costs of some policies where there's a debate and a difference of opinion between parties.
I would respectfully disagree with you. I think he has called it a hoax time and time and time again.
On Friday, South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem, Donald Trump's nominee to lead the Department of Homeland Security, will have her confirmation hearing before the Senate Intelligence Committee. Well, a major shakeup on the House Intelligence Committee. Speaker Mike Johnson has removed Ohio Congressman Mike Turner as chair, and because of term limits, he is now off the committee after more than 20 years. The speaker denied that President-elect Trump wanted him off, only telling reporters that he wants to go in a new direction. Democrats call the move dangerous.
He was basically sacked because he was trying to practice bipartisanship on the committee, a committee where bipartisanship is crucial given the gravity of the national security matters that we look at.
My concern is that we have someone who is interested in providing checks and balances on governmental excess. As complicated as our founding fathers were, they were on the right track in creating three separate but equal branches of government.
Sources familiar with the decision tell EWTN News that people in President-elect Donald Trump's orbit were opposed to Turner continuing as intel chair, saying Turner was seen as too close to the intelligence agencies that he was tasked with overseeing. Officials in California are assuring residents that as the week rolls on, dry conditions that led to the devastating fires may be improving.
We're going to get more marine influence in here. There's going to be a push of more moist air from the ocean. So we're going to have by far the best overnight recoveries that we've seen on this fire so far. And that means the humidity is going to rise up at night.
Meanwhile, home and business owners are beginning to return to their damaged properties, even as the flames still ravage parts of the area. Officials are attempting to clean up the debris and destruction, which you can see right here. Next steps will include rebuilding and finding the financing to do so. We pray for them. A Catholic movie producer and lawyer credits his home from being ravaged by the wildfires to the Epiphany home blessing that he prayed on January 6th before he and his family evacuated. And if you would like information on how to bless your home during the Epiphany, go to missions.ewtn.com and click on Seasons and Feast Days. And we have a lot more so to come here on EWTN News Nightly, including the church and Cuba. More than 500 prisoners are said to be released in Cuba, and we are learning more about the important role played by the Vatican. And the Pope's new autobiography is out today. We read it, and we will give you a preview. The government of Cuba says that it will release 553 prisoners, adding that the move is largely through the efforts of Pope Francis and his call for clemency in the 2025 Jubilee year. The Vatican calls the release, quote, a sign of great hope. Secretary of State Cardinal Pietro Parolin adds that it is important that Havana link the decision directly to the efforts of the Holy Father. Well, this comes just days after the Biden administration removed Cuba from the list of countries that are state sponsors of terror. The Vatican says that it supports the move, adding that it has worked with the White House to improve conditions in the island nation. The head of the Archdiocese of Miami, with a heavy Cuban population, says that he is optimistic the move is the right one. Archbishop Thomas Wensky says in part, quote, Cuba is on the verge of becoming a failed state and lacks the ability, quote, to represent a real threat to the U.S. The U.S. list of state sponsors of terror is now limited to Iran, North Korea, and Syria. And Archbishop Thomas Wensky from the Archdiocese of Miami joins us now. Your Excellency, thank you so much for your time today. I would like to get your reaction to the release of the more than 500 prisoners from Cuba, largely through the efforts of Pope Francis.
Yes, well, it's a welcome thing because the church in Cuba has been advocating for a couple of years now for the release of these prisoners. And 500 represents about maybe 20% of those that were in prison after the spontaneous protests that erupted on the island in July of 2021. And so hopefully this is the first of many other releases to come.
Yeah, I want to talk now about removing Cuba from the states that sponsor terrorism list. What was the reaction of the faithful from Cuba in your archdiocese when they heard this news earlier? And what is your reaction?
Well, first of all, I think the release of the prisoners and the lifting of the of this sanction of designation of a terrorist state are probably connected together. And in that sense, it gave perhaps the Vatican some leverage to get these prisoners released. Now, that I've said this in Miami to many Cubans here already, that, you know, taking off a label or putting on a label doesn't really change the reality of what Cuba is. And we know what Cuba is, and we know its difficulties, and just the removing the designation or putting it back on doesn't change that reality, unfortunately. Yeah. So I think most people will, you know, react just, you know, as it wasn't really earth shaking one way or the other. In one sense, you know, if we were really thinking that Cuba was a terrorist threat to the United States, we would not have let close to a half a billion Cubans into the country in the last 15 months. So, you know, I think it's that in itself shows that, you know, Cuba doesn't really threaten the United States. That doesn't mean that Cuba is not a bad actor in the region, but the Cubans coming to the United States represent no threat to the United States.
And I know that you've mentioned, Your Excellency, that Cuba is close to becoming a failed state. Talk to us more about that.
Well, we have, you know, a whole constellation of failed states. I tell people in Miami that we're surrounded by islands of pain: Haiti, Cuba, Venezuela, Nicaragua. And right now in Cuba, Cuba is undergoing one of the worst economic crises that it's had since the Soviet Union cut them off in the early 90s. Cuba lacks fuel, it lacks food, it lacks electricity, and it lacks people because its youth are leaving the country in increasing numbers, leaving behind the elderly, and therefore making difficulties for schools to have adequate number of teachers teaching the children that are remaining, etc. So Cuba is in a very difficult situation, and unfortunately, the leaders of the Cuban government don't seem to have any vision to move forward towards a transition that would perhaps help for a soft landing as Cuba, you know, transitions to another form of government or form of economy.
Well, Your Excellency, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today. We really appreciate it. God bless.
God bless you.
Next on EWTN News Nightly, a hopeful pope. The Holy Father released his new autobiography, Hope, today. We read it and found some interesting things inside. Plus, it was a banner month for Notre Dame, the jaw-dropping record that the cathedral just set. Is in a sling today after suffering a fall at his home this morning. Fortunately, Pope Francis only bruised his arm, and the sling is a precautionary measure just to be safe. This comes after a previous fall in December in which the 88-year-old pontiff bruised his cheek. Neither fall has kept the Holy Father from sticking to his very busy schedule. Pope Francis's new and widely anticipated autobiography, Hope, has hit bookshelves in 80 countries across the world. Written over 6 years, the book starts with Pope Francis's Italian roots and continues through his childhood, adulthood, and papacy. It includes photographs, memories, as well as unpublished material made personally available by the Holy Father himself. And joining us now from Rome is Frank Rocca, senior Vatican analyst at EWTN News. Frank, always good to be with you. So tell us, what sort of book is Hope, and how does it differ from previous works by Pope Francis?
Well, Pope Francis has produced well over 50 books in his almost 12-year pontificate. Most of them are book-length interviews. This one's a little different. It's a collaboration with an Italian editor, Carlo Musso, who met extensively with the Pope, had conversations with him, received written accounts from the Pope, and put that together along with other information that he got from other sources. The result, the first 30 years, the Pope recounts in first person chronologically. So that's kind of a traditional autobiography format. The rest of it is different. It's more thematic. It's more commentary on various issues. So it's not quite a typical autobiography that you would expect, but it does cover the Pope's life in all its major phases.
Frank, do we learn anything new about the Holy Father in this book?
Well, the biggest thing was what leaked last month in the Italian press, which is that when on his trip to Iraq in 2021, that they foiled an assassination attempt by suicide bombers. So there's nothing else that big or that hot in the book, let's say. Mostly it enriches our knowledge of different periods that we already had read about elsewhere. For example, his youth, he talks about that when he was little, he wanted to become a butcher when he grew up, or that he quarreled with an uncle who was an anti-Peron. And he was, as a teenager, supported Juan Perón, who was the Argentine leader. And then about his pontificate, he talks about how he felt when he was elected pope and his decision not to wear white trousers underneath his white cassock. So things like that, little bits of color that enrich our knowledge.
Yeah, definitely interesting. Before I let you go, does this book deal with any of the big controversies of his pontificate?
Yeah, it does. A number of them, including his decision to permit blessings for same-sex couples. And he's very strong about defending his decision to restrict the traditional Latin Mass. He's very severe on people who like the Mass. He says that they're practicing in backwardism, and it's ideology. And he even suggests that some of the priests who are drawn to it are mentally unbalanced. It's a very striking passage because it doesn't fit with the kind of sympathetic tone that he takes elsewhere in the book. And for that reason, it's very credible and human, because so it gives us a picture of the Pope.
Oh, Frank, thank you so much. We appreciate it. Frank Rocha, Senior Vatican Analyst at EWTN News. God bless.
Thank you.
Finally tonight, just 1 month after reopening, the Cathedral of Notre Dame is setting some records. Since its doors reopened to the public, 800,000 people have visited the renovated cathedral in Paris. That means that every day, an average of 30,000 people visit the medieval church. Entrance fee is free of charge, but visitors are advised to book in advance to be sure that they get in. Incredible. And we thank you for watching tonight. Remember, you can follow us on social media, Facebook, X, and Instagram at EWTN News Nightly. I'm Tracy Sable. Good night, and God bless.